Yeah, right.
The House Committee on Revenue for January 29th, 2009 will come to order. Thank you very much. We will start with an informational meeting on the Enterprise Zone study update. Paul?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to go down below, and Mazen and I will update the committee on what we found so far.
Great. Thank you. And committee, while they're doing that, let me just say that we're going to change the order slightly and do the two public hearings on 2161 and 2162 next. And then finally, we will hear the public hearing on 2065. Paul?
Mr. Chair, Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. I just want to give you a little bit of background about Senate Bill 151 from the last session that directed us to do a study of enterprise zones. And let me just tell you initially that we're not quite finished with that, so we're really updating you on kind of where we are at this point and hope to have a final report to you probably in March. And I'll let you know where we're at. Senate Bill 151 directed Legislative Revenue Office to file a report to evaluate the performance of enterprise zones and related tax incentives that are contained in ORS 285.050. And what it did was direct us to do an analysis to allow us to assess the degree to which incentives are significantly affecting investments and employment in enterprise zones, and to measure, look at statistical change in measures of local economic hardship. What we've done, and we've had the reason why we're a little bit behind schedule is we've had quite a bit of data requirements for the employment department. Of course, for them, this has been an extremely busy time. They have worked very closely with us. We did have a little bit of available salary dollars. So what we did was get a contract with Ed Waters. Ed is a former Legislative Revenue Office employee. He's the person that really, more than anybody, developed the Oregon Tax Incidence Model for us. So Ed's very familiar with the modeling techniques that we need. But Ed has prepared a report kind of updating where we are, and this is in your packet. It's called Progress Report for the Senate Bill 151 Enterprise Zone Project. And what we've done is really take three major approaches, and I'll have Mazen describe those in a little bit more detail. But the first is to look at the enterprise zone in an internal rate of return kind of calculation, and that to try to envision a local sponsoring government as an individual firm, and ask the question, you know, what kind of response do we have to get? How long does it take for us to get back the return on our investment? Whereas the investment, from the standpoint of the local government, is the tax revenue that's given up because of the exemption. So that's the first approach. The Economic Development Department, Art Fish, has done a lot of work on this, and it's given us some very good information. And we feel like we're very far along on that analysis, and that will be the first step in the final report. The second is to look at a shorter period of time where we can look at the employment in the zones versus a comparable area and see what kind of differences we can find. The time periods we picked, as so often are the case with any kind of analysis like this, are certainly partly determined by data availability. But employment department has gotten some very detailed information on employers, both payroll and total employment in these zones. So we can go down with geocoded data and go very specific, much more so than we could in the past. And they've really been the key for us in trying to do this kind of analysis. The 2 years that we have, as far as back as we can go, is 2003, and then the latest we have is 2006. We've got an 03 to 06 short-term period change to look at enterprise zone performance in terms of payroll employment compared to other areas during this period of economic growth. So we do have a, you know, we have a control group comparison. The second approach we have is we need to look at some broader socioeconomic variables like unemployment, per capita income, poverty. And really, in order to do that, we have to take a longer period of time, and we're pretty much relegated to the census period. So the last phase of this analysis is to compare 1990 with 2000. And that's actually the phase right now. We're just finishing the data gathering on that. The data gathering has been complete on the internal return portion, the short-term 03-06 period, and the 90 to 2000 period we're just about done with. So we'll be ready to put all of that together and should have something for you certainly in March at the latest. But I'll let Mazen walk through some of the details of the updated report, and then we can address any questions you have on how it's looking so far.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mazen Malik with Legislative Revenue Office. I don't feel like I probably should say a lot more than what Paul very eloquently said, and the risk of destroying what he just convinced. But really, thank you for the opportunity to study this thing. We've been waiting for this in Legislative Revenue Office for a very, very long time.
Where's that little clip?
Additionally, there was no additional funding to do this, but we really enjoyed it. Mr. Chair, I know this is a Senate bill, so the House is probably in a lot more waiting mode than you initiated the Senate bill. But the quick thing that we were trying to answer for ourselves is how do we come to a conclusion about these enterprise zones, knowing that there is always this issue of, well, would these companies have moved in and invested the amounts that they've invested, whether you give them the incentive or not? And then the other question is, how do you actually quantify these differences in employment and wages and so on? And once we decided to take three different tracks on how do you measure this, it became how do you design this experiment in order to be able to answer some questions. And the design of the experiment that we settled with is that we have a stratified sample, if you will, two stratified samples. One is that for the short term, as Paul was mentioning, from 2003-2006, and one is a longer term kind of sample. The stratified sample would look at different places in the state. So as you'd see towards the middle of the first page, we have five categories, if you will, five status, where you have urban metro, urban western valley, rural west side, rural east side, and remote. And what we looked at in those is you have in these areas requirement to find two different economic areas, if you will. One would be an enterprise zone area, and the other one will be a comparable or a comparing kind of control group, comparing areas. The issues that we wanted to know, once you look at these, you have certain criteria for the short term. The criteria for the short term, number one wanted to be, we want everybody to be established before the year 2000. The second one, that it's still in existence in the year 2006. The third is that it has continuous classification as an enterprise zone since its inception. And the third, that it has at least some utilization. For the short-term sample, we required utilization of the enterprise zone. This was not required in the long-term sample because we wanted to see whether the long-term sample, if it was declared to be an enterprise zone but never actually activated, never actually utilized, what difference would it make in that sense too? That's important information as well. So After doing that, now we want to have the 2 points of time for each. So you take the enterprise zone, you look at it the way it was in 2003, and then you look at it again, what difference it had made in 2006. Now, you look at an area that is comparable to it, and the comparison went through a progress, if you will, of change. At the time, we were looking at Hutchman Index, and that basically compares different areas of employment, income, and so on. But that didn't work so well, so the employment department started looking more at geographical resemblance between the two areas. In the same time, a simple correlation of employment, that was a criteria for them. So these two areas you want to look, if, for example, employment and wages went up in the enterprise zone area, is that the same thing that happened in the non-enterprise zone areas? If they stayed the same, is that also something that happened in both the same areas? And or even if there was a decline, is that something that you could say about both of these areas in the same time in a way that you're able to make the conclusion, statistically significant conclusion on my end, that enterprise zones have actually made a difference or made it different for that area to become more economically viable than the area the other non-enterprise zone. So that's the short term, and the short term is just to give it a quick and very concentrated way of looking thing. But for the to be more thorough and be able to describe things in different ways, as a poverty rate and how that implication of an enterprise zones in a larger context, that's why we went also with the long term, the 1990-2000. That's a 10-year comparison. And in that comparison, you would see in the second page the long-term sample enterprise zones. These samples go a longer time. A lot of the enterprise zones have been in existence in a long time, probably since the inception. But few of them were established only in 1990 and after. So those... as I mentioned before, the one of the requirements was, or did not, we relaxed the requirement that these enterprise zones need to be utilized. We wanted to see whether that makes a difference or not. If that's good information or not a good information, we wanted to kind of examine that issue and see whether the enterprise zones in areas A and B, let's say the area that has an enterprise zone, didn't make any difference, and the area that didn't have any enterprise zones, maybe the change, you know, just happens, as you say. If they build it, they will come, kind of thing. Finally, the way we started... pulling that data from the employment department has been a really very laborious exercise, because you have to go and through all the time by census tracts. Census tracts was the unit of comparison that we took with the enterprise zone. So you take the census tracts. Census tracts are U.S. Census definitions of areas of about 4,000 people or... That kind of, and then when you add them together and make them, they would become whether they overlay them over an area or not. So each one of these census tracts has certain characteristics of employment, poverty, household income, education level, and so on. And those are the building blocks for the comparison studies that we were pulling from the employment data. And of course, Employment went through a change from the SIC codes to the NAICS codes, and it was putting them in direct comparison was also a kind of a good exercise to go through. And so at this time, Mr. Chair, we are looking at starting to sift out all that long-term data. Hopefully, we would be able to get this in the 3-4 weeks coming, but just to be more able to make that conclusion, we're thinking somewhere about the first week or second week of March, we'll be able to give you a lot more insightful ideas of how the enterprise zone study is. We don't expect the final word to say enterprise zones give you that much quantitative difference, but whether it makes a difference, I mean, that's what we're expecting. The more definitive ideas probably will be better, but we expect that it might need further studies down the line.
If I might add, Mr. Chair, another thing I think that has been kind of in the background of this analysis is a desire on the part of the legislature, and I know this was a goal of our previous Senate Revenue Chair, was to develop a way of looking at the incentives in general to get a sense of, you know, what kind of criteria could we have to try to evaluate their performance. And so hopefully this will be a prototype, and we'll start us down that path. I know that the interested parties and the enterprise zones, which include economic development, include the local governments, not only the counties and the cities, but also the special districts have been very interested in this issue. So we can get a clearer objective measures on what we could expect from these types of incentives. One of the things that's taken us a long time is to break out a sample of these different areas, but in my mind that seems really critical because you're looking at such different kinds of economic environments, the Portland metro area versus Representative Vence's district, for example, some huge differences in what to expect in those locations. So we thought it would be valuable to have that kind of stratification geographically to give you some more insight about how this tool works.
Thank you. Questions, comments? Yes, Representative Call, Representative Vence, and then someone down here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple things, actually. There is talk oftentimes about enterprise zones, urban renewal zones, being able to us being able to put parameters on ways in which they're used. And one of the ones that comes up oftentimes is requiring prevailing wage on the capital construction that goes into the development of an urban renewal area. Wondering if you've looked at it from that angle as well. So not looking just at the past benefits that have come, but whether or not putting limitations or requirements on getting the tax abatement with regards to prevailing wage affects the future viability of the district. Does that make sense?
I think it does, Representative Call. That's certainly a valid policy question. We're not really in a position to try to address it in this study because we are, as you say, looking at the past. So we're looking at past policies and how effective they've been. There was a lot of interest, I know, in interim committees, not only to look at employment and not turn it into a job count kind of thing, but also to look at the wages that are associated with the zone. So that might give us some insight in that area, but it wouldn't allow us to address whether the policy of requiring prevailing wage is an impediment or not. So we're really kind of stuck with how the policy's been carried out and analysis of that.
Mr. Chair, could I ask?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Just a different question. When an enterprise zone is created, are all of the jurisdictions that are receiving property taxes, are they coming together in agreements, or the cities and the counties, the school boards, anybody who has a vested interest in that property tax, are they coming together to agree on the creation of an urban renewal or an enterprise zone, rather?
There's a sponsoring government, that sponsors that enterprise zone. And I think there's been a lot of concern about how much agreement there is, particularly from the special district side. And that's really been one of the forces here in trying to look at the effectiveness, because there's been concern that whenever the property tax revenue is given up, there's an expectation that the services will continue and without the increment of revenue. So I think that is one of the driving forces here, to really look at the effectiveness so that all governments can feel that, you know, that these are working or they're not working, and that can help in that decision.
But is it different from, say, an urban renewal district where the urban renewal agency is the one acting to create a district without any input from any of the jurisdictional partners who have a vested interest in that property tax base? Would you say that the process for an enterprise zone is different, and if so, significantly so?
Well,
Mr. Chair, Representative Hull, it is different. The urban renewal districts, of course, have... usually would have a lot more defined area, and it has a concept of the TIF, freezing of. So at one time or another, not everybody necessarily has to completely. There is a time, theoretically at least, where the freezing would be unfrozen. The way the enterprise zones come in, everybody needs to be part of the process. However, not everybody needs to agree. The majority of the districts, if you will, taxing districts that have the highest, and I can't remember if it's 51% or more, highest amount of loss in the tax base. Once you reach that threshold, you're able to do that. However, enterprise zones are defined in number. They're limited to 50 enterprise zones in the state, and by type of what kind of enterprise zones. So it's not necessarily that without legislative action, you cannot add new enterprise zones. You have to have that working. While urban renewal districts are not necessarily in need of that legislative action to do that. So there are these differences. However, they're becoming or being used in a way that seem to be similar to the goals that are being done with the enterprise zones. Now, urban renewal districts seems to be emphasizing jobs, while their original intent was to change the blighted areas. And so, you know, things are becoming closer, and perhaps you would be faced in the future with the idea of making delineation of what's different between the two programs and why.
Representative Call, we have had a review team that's helped us on this project that consists of representation from the counties and League of Oregon Cities and the special districts, as well as the Economic Development Department. We'll make sure we get the full team here when the final report is done. I think they could probably address your question better, because they're the ones that have actually operated the program and are very knowledgeable of it.
Thanks.
Representative Betts.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Will this report, when it's complete, include a reflection of interviews with those that came to the enterprise zones and built their businesses there to find out what prompted them to come and whether they would have been here otherwise?
Vice Chair Benz, no. This is just a statistical report. We haven't included that in our methodology, so... You know, we don't have the expense to do that. I think you could certainly get some good insights from the department on what they've experienced, but that's always a tough methodology to establish. Interviews can give you some good information, but you know, you would I'm not sure how unbiased an answer you would get if you asked the recipient that question, but it would be something you could follow up on with direct interviews, and I think could give you some information.
Okay, please.
Yeah. How will the study reflect situations where the business moved from one town, let's say, without an enterprise zone to another that had one, and I'm just wondering if what exactly the benefit is then to the to the greater good, if that's what's happening.
Vice Chair Benz, you know, I think you're hitting on what's always been this kind of dual purpose of enterprise zones, and that really ultimately gets to what your objectives are for the program as policymakers. Initially, I think there was a lot of sense that it was a regional growth program, that you're really trying to shift economic growth within the state from areas that may be more competitive and get plenty of growth over to areas that are not getting the growth. So it was kind of a regional strategy for stimulating growth in areas of the state. So in that sense, you know, you're really not expecting it to have an impact on total growth. You're just expecting it to influence the region. On the other hand, there's also kind of this overall economic development perspective that, gee, it should make Oregon more competitive in terms of attracting capital and therefore job growth. So there is that kind of dual purpose. And we've gotten into this discussion. In fact, I know it's even come up that why don't we just make the whole state an enterprise zone? Well, that gets, you know, then you're really looking at state policies to try to, you know, stimulate overall growth. And I'm not sure if the enterprise zone is the appropriate tool to do that. Really, it's more in terms of state policy tools, that tax credits and those kind of things you look at, or changes in expenditure policy to attract overall growth. So, you know, I think that does get a little bit confusing. For us, what we've done here is we've looked at growth in the zone areas versus comparable areas that don't have a zone. So what we're trying to get at is how effective is the zone as a tool to stimulate regional growth versus a non-zone area. So we are looking at really more from a kind of a regional strategy standpoint.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I also have to mention the enterprise zone study does not include an evaluation of the SIP program, the strategic initiative?
Investment.
So the SIP is where, well, the tool by which Intel and a lot of the high-tech companies were brought into the state and given the large amounts of property tax relief and so on. So that is a separate program that is not included in the enterprise zone.
Yes, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Mazin, Salem was early in with enterprise zones, and I think they would count them as wildly successful, to the point of having whole industries come in, build, and then go away globally within the same enterprise zone. I'm speaking of Mitsubishi, which the technology changed. They came, had 1,300 jobs in Salem at one point, and now they're all gone. And so, you know, those were 1,300 nice jobs. Sorry to see them go. My question is, when did the statewide limit thing come in? Was the original concept that the state would authorize enterprise zones, or were they originally a local government function, and then the state came along and said, we got way too many of them?
Representative Berger, the enterprise zone is, I mean, the state has overall direction of property tax exemptions through the property tax statute. So the state initially authorized enterprise zones in the 80s as a regional tool. So I think the notion was more this regional growth for areas that were lagging behind. And then we did see a growth in the number of enterprise zones over time. So, and then, of course, the more of that growth you get, the more an enterprise zone becomes a distinguishing characteristic if there's a whole lot of them. So that's been the trend, has been to expand the number of. Now they do have they do expire, and we do have a history of some of them that have expired and then not been renewed. So that the sponsoring governments have to make that decision to use them and support them. But the state, you know, sets up the overall structure, and the state has a limit on the number that can be out there.
Has there always been a limit, or was that? I mean, from the first enterprise zone in the state, which dates back to what, 88?
Back to the mid 80s.
Yeah.
We've got some in the sample from 86.
Yeah. Has the state always limited the number, or did that come about because of pushback when the growth of the program?
I believe the state has always limited the number, and then that limit has grown. It's increased to now. I think we're at what?
50. Yeah, we've changed, Representative Berger, we've changed the limit.
40. A number of times. Yeah, yeah. I'm aware of
this. This is like a debt limit. You keep.
Good luck with your study, gentlemen. Have fun.
Mr. Chair, just one question. 50, I think the last time we increased it was during the 2005 session. Are they all, maybe you answered this and I missed this, are they all being used at this point, all 50? I mean, you have to apply. There's 50 designated to be used. How many of those are being used? Do we know the answer?
I don't know the answer to that, Representative Bruin, but I know the person who does.
Yeah. There you have it.
So I will make sure that you get that. In fact, we'll make sure he's here when we have the final report. Art Fish is the person who's really worked on this program, and he monitors it very closely, and we have all the long spreadsheets that has all that information.
Charts and graphs and stuff.
Yes, Art's got it all. We'll talk to him.
Well, Representative, the main question is, all enterprise zones are being utilized, and the answer is no. Not all enterprise zones are being utilized. There's a few that are not, that just didn't work out, I guess.
And in fact, that did come up with the review team about, you know, one of the things that we first suggested was, well, if we're looking over this long period of time, we shouldn't use any zones that have not, you know, that haven't had any activity. And the response we got from one of our team members, Tony Ruffalo, said, well, that's, you know, that's creating a bias, because you want to see how effective these are. You guys should include in that sample these zones that are there available but are not being used. So, I mean, that's true. That is a more unbiased way of looking at the overall effectiveness. So we did make sure we included some of that in the sample, too, just to see what are the characteristics of those zones that have been available but haven't had any activity, and that might give us some insight, too.
And compare that to the characteristics of those that have been used.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, and if we're trying to answer that question, Mr. Chair, is whether the enterprise zones are effective in general, you need to include that and say, well, this one isn't.
Sure. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I'm looking forward to this report. Is it correct to say that the final results will include not just an indication of whether or not an investment would have occurred but for the enterprise zone, but also indications of changes in the size, timing, or location of that investment?
I'll start off. Maybe Madison can add to this, but you know, I don't think we can really answer fully the but for question. I think we can say there's evidence that there's correlation between use of these zones in particular areas and in growth, and so. You know, I don't think we can ever really get at the causality and say, yeah, these businesses are located here because of the zone. We can just say that the use of zone is correlated with higher growth rates or higher wages over this period of time. So, in my mind, I always think of the economic development incentives as really, you're changing the probability. You offer these tools, the probability of investment may be 10%. Maybe you increase it to 15%, which may be something that we can't really measure very effectively. But what we try to look at is how much correlation we have with growth in those zones versus use of those tools. And so, and that's why we've got the comparison groups there to hope give us some insight. But I don't know how definitive that's going to be, is what I'm saying.
Well, I'm sorry, I don't think I asked my question clearly. I guess I would acknowledge that answer, and so I guess my question is not will we answer the but-for test, but in but rather in addition to measuring that probability in a binary change of a of a investment taking place or not taking place, will we also look at if an investment does take place, did the enterprise zone perhaps accelerate that investment because it was more cost-effective to make that investment earlier because they didn't have to wait for sufficient capital? Does it make an investment that would have taken place larger than it would have otherwise been because of the enterprise zone? Does it change perhaps the geographic location of it, which I think is more the binary question? But it seems like there's more than just what's the probability of the investment taking place. It's also how big is it and how quickly did it happen?
Vice Chair Bailey, I feel another study coming. but this is, I think the main idea. This, let me track back. One of the difficulties with pulling the data at the time was when you pull some data for certain firms or companies. Now, what an enterprise zone at the year, let's say, 2003, many of them, maybe not most or all, but many, have changed names, have changed designation, type of industry, and also with the 1990 to 2000 changes from the SIC to the NAICS have changed classification. Some of them retained the enterprise zone tax credit, but became something else. So it was difficult from that standpoint to trace back or trace forward, if you will, where that incentive or that company became. And that was one of the difficulties with pulling the data. Now, that in essence was somehow we found a way of bypassing this difficulty and getting something. If this group of employers in the enterprise zones existed at this point and at this point, and we went back and saw if there was any name changes, any companies that acquired other companies, those are accounted for. But the main idea will still be for this study is to see the differences in at least employment payroll in the short term between the time there was from this point in time to this point in time in two different places geographically in an area that has an enterprise zone, area that did not have an enterprise zone. Is there a significant difference between these two areas? And is that significant also temporally as well as spatially? And that also is the larger inference that we would like to make for the 1990 to 2000. Did it impact poverty rates in the whole area? Did that alleviate some of that? Did it impact different types of statistical income of the census that you know is being tracked, the wage rates changes and so on. These are the things that this report will be able to answer. Mm-hmm. And once we come to these answers, is you know these things are making a difference. We would probably anticipate that will be a first step, if you will, or a base to do other things, to answer other questions.
I think, if I may, Vice Chair Bailey, that I think really to get at your question, I think you need to have some kind of a time series, not only just the 2 points in time, but looking at annual data on how that those investments are taking place. Is that, you know, that would get you that sense of whether it speeds things up, for example, or changes the timing of it. So I don't think we'll be able to address that very well because we're looking at these two different points in time, just the 2 points.
Final follow-up, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
Please.
Thank you. Then would it be correct to say that perhaps because, if I'm understanding you correctly, Mazen, that because this study compares outcomes and changes to the overall wage rate or poverty rate in two different areas, that in some sense differences in magnitude or timing of investments to some degree comes out in the wash a little bit because you're looking at the outcomes of what those investments create?
That is correct. However, we also are trying to touch on that issue by the third leg of the analysis, the internal rate of return kind of thing, is how long or what is a rate of return that is viable, if you will, allows local governments to give that in order to be able to acquire those jobs. So that segment of the analysis will also, take time and look into this issue a lot more. However, I don't think we would be able to make one-to-one connection between them. Maybe we'll be able to answer what is internal rate of return, but whether we will be able to capture it and how much. Always the question that comes out is how much are we paying per job out of tax credits, if you will. I don't know if we would reach that answer completely at this time, but we're making a lot of steps towards doing so.
Thank you, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been studying the enterprise zones for about 5 years now, having been on the Economic Development Committee for those past two sessions, and I want to make a couple of comments, and one of them is this study. I think it's a great idea. I think it will. You may see a little bit from it, but I don't think you're going to see all the answers that you want to see because there are so many variables. If you ask two towns, one who didn't have an enterprise zone and one who did, if they're the same, they'll tell you no. They're not the same, no matter what two towns you pick. And so there are a huge number of variables, including, the question, why did they pick this company pick this town, and we won't know that answer. We will not know that answer. And in addition, the other comment is the fact that cities or counties are, have to request to have an enterprise zone, and some of them aren't used, must tell us something. And I think that's something that that should be looked at very closely.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you. We're waiting with bated breath for the final report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A great opportunity.
So, let's move on then from the information meeting and open a public hearing on House Bill 2161.
Good morning. Morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2161 is an effort on the part of Department of Revenue to update archaic language related to central assessment statute. Since its original adoption in 1909, the central assessment statutes have not had a comprehensive review. So
you think that once a century we should do that?
We are in 21st century, and this language was written in the very beginning of 20th century. So what this bill does is update archaic language, reorders definitions, and conforms language throughout the central assessment statutes. The examples that are cited are like dropping words like wagon and telegraph and others. It also permits appeal from notice of intent to impose delinquency penalty within 20 days from mailing of notice. Currently written, appeals may have to wait several months. And this bill also changes lien date for taxes levied on electric distribution system to March 1st of each year from February 1st, and that ensures consistency between subsections.
Thank you. Mr. Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is John Phillips with the Oregon Department of Revenue. And just by way of background, I think Dave did a wonderful summary over the overall bill. By way of background, in 2004, we were looking at these statutes, and we thought now is the time, if any, to make some changes. And so we gathered a group together of stakeholders that are affected by the central assessment statutes. We came out of that group with three ideas for bills. By just prior to the 07 session, we decided to drop one of those ideas and proceed with two. Just in December before the O session, we had two bills, one that would make some program changes and one that would be more cleanup, modernization, archaic language type bill. Just before the 07 session then, there were some concerns expressed by some stakeholders that we had been working with, so we pulled that bill. The other bill proceeded and you passed it in the 07 session. Now we're bringing this one back and we think it's ready for you to look at. I think, like I said, Day did a very good overview. I have a section-by-section overview of the bill for you, just to apologize for pummeling you with information. But what it does in the beginning is it provides a statement of legislative findings. We wanted to be sure and assure everyone that it was not our intent in this particular bill to change the law or your policy on how central assessed properties are appraised or dealt with, but that the primary focus is non-substantive. I can then go over. I would like to talk specifically about Section 2 and then Section 15, if possible, and then maybe leave the questions for you if you have anything else on any of the other sections.
Please, go ahead.
Okay. In Section 2, this is the part that looks the most suspicious in terms of a policy change, and so I want to highlight what it actually does. In this section, the taxpayer files a statement with the department, and if it's timely filed, there's no issue. If it's not timely filed, then there's a penalty, and then the value is added, and then it goes through the same way, the same process of all other property. But because the statute was written a long time ago, and it refers to that the delinquent penalty, okay, now you're paying a penalty for having filed late, What's the process for that? Well, the process is that unless it's paid, it becomes a lien on the property, and you can apply to the director of the department to waive that lien, that penalty, excuse me. And the director can only review that appeal for waiver just during the director's review, which is from June 15th to August 1st. So our concern with this was that it's not about an appeal of the value of property. That occurs elsewhere. And there's a 30-day allowance for that. But what we were concerned about was property that's discovered, that the statement was not filed, that the notice is given, let's say in November or December or January, and then the taxpayer has to wait with a lien on their property until June to ask the director to waive it. Then the conditions are that the director can consider are in the statute, and this was added a few sessions back. Is there good and sufficient cause for their failure? Will waiving the penalty encourage tax compliance in the future? And other considerations. So that's what this section does, is it says not all of these things occur during a nice tight time frame in the summer. They can occur year-round. And so it does that. You might ask, where does the 20 days come from, and doesn't that seem short? The 20 days, like I said, is not about appealing the value. The value appeal process is in another statute, and that's a 30-day, and that's standard for most other types of property. The 20 days, we borrowed from another statute in Chapter 311 where the assessor sends a notice out, and the taxpayer has a 20 days to respond to that notice. So it's a parallel statute change in our minds. So that is not necessarily it's not really a modernization or a housekeeping thing, but it's more to make it function, we think, and make it work for taxpayers and the department.
Are you entertaining questions on this specific?
Yes, please. Representative Berger.
Yeah,
yes.
Thank you. John, if I understand you correctly, in this case, you feel you are acting sort of the way a county clerk would act in terms of notification of your right to appeal this to the director. Am I correct in that, and that's why you came up with 20 days, because that's what county clerks would give an ordinary taxpayer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, yes, for the waiver of the appeal where there's a good and sufficient cause, right.
Okay. Put a little perspective around this. I know centrally assessed is not a big universe. How many, have you got a number? How many centrally assessed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, about 400 companies.
Okay.
They're like PGE and Northwest.
My only concern here is that in modern America, you don't even get your attorney to write a letter in 20 days, let alone analyze, you know. These are big, complicated. 20 days seems very, very short in this realm. Who's helped by this? You, the centrally assessed property people, were they in on this conversation? I mean, I can just visualize a letter going out and they say, we've got 20 days to respond, call the attorneys, and 500 attorney phones light up and everybody's trying to figure out what's going on, and, you know, this deadline looms. Put me in reality here as how this really works on the ground. Am I right? Will the attorneys light up? And
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I don't anticipate that for a couple of reasons. One, we discussed this in our work group and our stakeholder group. Now, that was a few years back. As soon as we came out with this idea fresh again this year, we shared it with our stakeholders. We had a meeting at the department, invited all the people affected by this legislation. We then met with Associated Oregon Industries and talked with them and attorneys that represent taxpayers. And I don't know.
Yeah, I don't see them back there. I don't see them back. That worries me a little.
If there is a concern, this bill is also not scheduled for a work session today. So,
yeah.
We're very open to listening to any screams or concerns that come up, but we haven't heard any yet.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you for indulging. I'm raising this because I don't see them back there, so presumably they are watching this, and if they have issues, they will come forward.
Yeah, thank you. I agree with the implication, Representative, that the object of this process is to set up a system that works.
Exactly.
And that doesn't disadvantage taxpayers who have a good cause for an appeal.
And does, as I believe the Department of Revenue is trying to do, simplify this whole process and make it clear what
right.
the roles, responsibilities, and timelines are. That's what this
right.
what this bill is about. I just don't. It's a very complicated area of taxation. I don't have a good sense of whether this does this or not, and I don't know how I'd get that unless I were a
yeah.
rail car company or yeah. something.
Well, it's really a process question
yes.
rather than a tax question. But I
yeah.
agree. I agree with the point that your question implies.
And I think
yeah.
it applies for this entire bill, John. And there's just a lot of people I don't see back there, and I don't know whether that's good or bad.
That's one reason why we haven't scheduled it for a work session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're putting everyone on notice today. We're looking at this pretty seriously, and if they don't show up, then we'll assume they don't have any objections.
There you go, Mr. Chair. Right. Thank you.
Representative Vance. Oh,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And on the same line, actually, it's line 16. It's 20 days from the mailing, and so actually, it's not 20 days from receipt. And so when I see these, that's one of the lawyers whose phone does ring. usually you have like 2 days, and that's just not enough. So if I was in charge of it, knowing what's going to happen, I'd change the mailing to receipt. And just because there's just as much time there, and I don't see what the value of the 20 days is. So when you start it from the mailing. So, anyway, I was going to raise the same issue, so I'm glad Representative Berger raised it also.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, I think the department is open to changing the time frame. It's difficult for us to know when receipt is. We know when we mail it, but we don't necessarily know when it's received unless there's some certification or something like this. Is that what you were thinking?
Yeah, are these sent by regular mail instead of certified then?
I believe they are.
Yeah.
Well, I can
then,
check on that.
Then our only choice is, I was assuming certified, so if not, then you'd have to just, the only remedy is to extend it from 20
extend
to something else, right?
Sure,
yeah.
Sure.
All right. Other questions on this section? If not, go ahead and talk about the other section you wanted to talk about. I think you said 15.
Yes, Mr. Chair, section 15. Section 15 changes a lien date from February 1 to March 1. And I just call this to your attention because last session, Senate Bill 172 changed the filing deadline for electrical cooperatives that are subject to this statute, and it moved it from February 1 to March 1 to give them an extra month to file. The link was not made to the lien date, so now the lien actually becomes effective prior to the filing of the return, and so this just conforms the two, so it's not really substantively changing anything in our opinion, but I want to call it to your attention.
Well, it reduces the headache factor, doesn't it?
We think so.
Yeah. All right.
And finally, as I mentioned, we did have conversations with industry and with the stakeholders, and in a December meeting, concerns were expressed about definitions that begin on page 3 at line 42. The definitions of unit, and then the next page, the definition of use. And so we just agreed to ask for an amendment to have those pulled out because we thought that if industry thought that there was a substantive change, then that did not meet with our intention. And so we just asked to pull those out. So you should have an amendment in front of you, which would be a dash one amendment.
Yeah, we do. Colleagues have the dash one amendment that does exactly what you described. It removes sub 13 and sub 14 on page 3 and bottom of 3, top of 4. Do we need a definition of unit or use and used? Because without this language, there is no definition of those terms, I assume.
Mr. Chair, you're absolutely correct. And because of that, over the years, there have been a number of court cases that we believe, or our attorneys believe, that actually provide clarity in terms of what these two terms mean. So,
okay.
One, we could either put it in statute and try to match it up with the interpretation that exists today, or use what we're using now.
So this is the lawyer's problem. They have a definition that they think they understand based on court law. They look at these definitions and they think, well, gee, we're not sure this is the same.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And that's what it sounds
yes.
like. All right. And they'd prefer to use the definitions they already are comfortable with that the court has given them.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
All right. Thank you. Did you have other testimony that you wanted to bring today?
Not on this bill.
Other questions? We're not hearing. We're not working it today. Representative Bentz.
One thought on page 7, line 8. I think the result of adding the language historical or original and then tacking on book value just confuses it. So you'd want one or the other because they're not necessarily going to be the same.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, the way I understand this is just by leaving the term cost in, it is a little more open to interpretation, and by specifying that it's either historical or original, then it offers the opportunity for the taxpayer who might not have originally purchased that or who may have, depending on their circumstances, to use one or the other.
I'm sorry, follow up.
Please.
The historical or original is fine with me. It's the word end book value that follows. That is the problem.
Okay, thank you. Just a second. Can I
yes,
invite
please.
Some
oh,
expert?
Absolutely. This is the time to do that.
Mr. Chair, fellow members of the committee, my name is Mary Seaton. I'm a manager with the valuation section of the Department of Revenue and a former utility appraiser. As far as the what we ask for when we have companies file is a statement showing the original cost or the historical, which is the start point, and then we also ask for the book value. So what we are, that's two ends of the same asset. Basically, where did it start? Where do you have it now? And the reason we do that is for an approach called the historic cost-less depreciation method.
Yeah, please, Representative Pence.
Not to make too big a deal of it, it's just that my experience has been that book value had about 15 different definitions. And so I guess the question is historical or original in your mind the same as book value and you're merely saying it twice, or are they two different things and you're asking for two different reports?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, committee members, no, historical cost is where you start. And so it's the beginning for us. The book value would be where you end up after several years.
What he's asking.
The historical versus original, the reason we make a distinction is that historical one can be what did you pay for it and you may have purchased it used, or did you buy it new? Is it original or is it historical and to whom? There are companies that have different costs that they book or different things they call them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, perhaps we can do a little more research into the book value definition that we use.
Right, that would be good.
Sure.
And would that be helpful?
That would be great.
I'll get back
to
you. Thank you.
Right. This is the time to get into the weeds on technical changes. Other questions now? I don't have anyone else signed up on this bill. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on House Bill 2161? I don't see anybody. So with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2161, and we'll open a public hearing on the next bill, which is 2162. Please.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2162 relates to the start date of appeal when the final order of the local property tax board is hand-delivered. When ORS 305-280 added personal delivery as an alternative delivery option, it failed to specify the start date of an appeal for hand-delivered orders. So what this bill does is it stipulates that 30-day appeal period will trigger at the time of delivery when the final order of the local property tax board is personally delivered to the appellant.
Okay. Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. Not sure what I can add to that other than The bill did pass in the mid-90s that allowed for hand delivery following a hearing. The order is handed to the appellant, and then everyone looks to Chapter 305 to say, okay, well, how soon does that taxpayer have to appeal? And it says the taxpayer has to appeal within 30 days of the date the order was mailed. This never became a problem for now on to 10-plus years until someone didn't file an appeal and claimed they still had time. Years after the order was handed to them. A simple, conforming fix, and I hope you find it that way.
That's good.
The ingenuity of taxpayers will never cease, will it? Comments, questions? It looks like this is one we might have been able to work today, but we don't have it on the calendar for that. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a comment that this is Mr. Daybeck's, kind of opening bills sitting up there, and I'd like it noted for the record that he's being hazed as a freshman by Mr. Warner by these kinds of bills.
Yes, and whoever gets to carry them will
really appreciate it, and I can see that I think lawyers and economists go to the head of the line on these kinds of bills.
That's true. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 2162? I take it that the taxpayer you're referring to is not in the room today.
Mr. Chair, I don't know who that person was.
Oh, thank you. I didn't expect an answer to that question. All right. Unless there's any other witness, I don't see any. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2162. Thank you very much. And then our final item for today is House Bill 2065. Paul, who's working 2065? With that, we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2065.
proposing.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, we're talking about the reconnect, so.
Yes.
But that's tomorrow's hearing.
That'll be tomorrow's hearing.
Special bonus meeting.
Special bonus meeting, which I hope to get around and talk to people about before then, but maybe I won't. Who knows?
Members of the committee, House Bill 2065 is the biennial session revisers bill that makes technical changes in the Oregon tax statutes. Our legislative council goes through the statutes relating to taxes and looks through references that no longer apply because of changes in other statutes. Very much the cleanup bill in each session. And the intent of the bill is to make no changes in policy, no changes in the way the statutes operate. Its direct intention is to clean things up and to make sure the references are still valid and to make sure that the ordering in the statutes is correct. I've asked Kate Toswell to be here from council to address any questions that the committee has on the changes. I know there are some changes deleting reference to a position that no longer exists in Department of Revenue, for example. There's some reordering in the Affordable Housing Lenders Credit back on page 20. You can see how that's restructured. But again, the intent of those changes is just to reorder the statutes and make them consistent.
Well, why don't you come forward and perhaps describe in a little more detail what you did and who has had a chance to comment on the draft.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. I'm Kate Toswell from Legislative Council. And as we were just looking at the bill, our intention is, if at all possible, to err on the side of not making substantive changes. The purpose of this bill, and it's similar to the revisers bill that addresses other sections, is primarily to make changes to grammar or syntax that we see in the tax statutes. As Mr. Warner indicated, there are a few instances where we have repealed sections, and those sections, I believe, are ones that are obsolete in that they apply to, I believe there's one that deals with missing people missing in combat in Vietnam, and they're provisions that have not been used or have not been claimed in a number of years. And then there are places like on page 20 where we've reordered a section. Our preference is typically to put definitions at the beginning of a section. In this case, the definitions were actually in the middle of a lengthy section. So there's been a reordering of that section. And I can take questions about particular items in the revisers bill. But again, where there was a question as to whether something was a substantive or policy change as opposed to a structural or grammatic change, we have avoided making those changes and including them in this bill.
And has the bill been reviewed by the department or?
Absolutely. And in fact, the changes of suggested repeals were at the direction of the department, and the department has gone through each of these sections. And we've in fact discussed anything where it looked like it might approach a substantive change.
And you haven't gotten any responses back from anyone suggesting that there was a problem with any of these?
Absolutely not, yeah. Chair Barnhart.
That, of course, is the definition of a technical change, isn't
yes.
it? Yeah.
And
yes.
as I've said, there are instances where reasonable minds could differ and something might appear just to be changing tabulation or changing paragraphs to subsections, and where it wasn't clear that there might not be a policy effect. We've avoided including those sorts of changes.
And then the last question I've got, and then I'll recognize Representative Riley, is the notes that you've included here are following the section that they refer to, I think.
Yes, they are.
And they're not actually, under our rules, they're not actually part of the statute.
That's correct. The notes, just as with, if there are captions for the convenience of the reader, it's the same thing. They're not actually enacted into law, even though they fall below the enacting clause.
Great. Thank you. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The one thing that I did see in here was mentioned, and that's the missing in combat in Vietnam. And I want to know if that has been vetted by the military department. I'd like to know, because there is some problem with that in my mind.
What section is that? Could you give it to us? And then answer the question, if you would.
I believe that's 315, 254, but let me just confirm that. And as for input from the military department, Representative Riley and Chair Barnhart, I could not say affirmatively whether that has happened. I know that the department has reviewed each of these and has, I believe, where there's another agency with involvement, they've run them past them, and certainly the intent is to remove sections where no one has used them, no one has claimed them in the case of a credit or an exemption, and where they are sections that are in the ORS and are just not being used. And I think same thing goes with there are sections relating to underground storage tanks. But so, if I could, I'm just going to see.
So, excuse me just a moment. You're referring to Section 19 or Section 19 and 20 or something else?
If I could take one moment.
Sure.
I believe it's in Chapter 316. It's actually, it would repeal 316.074.
Okay.
And that is Section 20. And I believe our understanding was that is something that has not been utilized.
I believe that has not been utilized. The question in my mind is it still open to be utilized? And
right.
Is it still a possibility? And I think that's one that I would like to not see taken out.
Well, Representative Riley, I think it's a great idea to inquire before we make any decisions
right.
about that. And it doesn't sound like that inquiry has been made yet.
Right.
Yes.
Chair Barnhart, I could not speak to the depths of the inquiry as to that.
Right, and so that's something we may want to look into. One of the reasons you hold a public hearing and then later work it, Bill, is so that you can close the loop on things before you actually get a bill to the floor. And then you said something about tanks?
Yes. I believe there are a number of sections that have not been used, and in fact may not be usable at this point because of their applicability dates. And we do see in the tax law situations where we will have a section that remains codified, and it gives the opportunity to taxpayers, if they have an amended return or if there's a carry forward, to continue to use it. But after a certain point, we will repeal it, and it's not something that has a natural sunset, if you will. And I think in the case of 316.834,
that's Section 23.
Yes, that is Section 23, and that deals with underground storage tank pollution prevention, and it makes reference to a grant in 1991. And my understanding of that is, again, it is a provision that is not in use. And it's the feeling of the department that enough time has passed where it is not being claimed. And I think in the case of that, it's not even possible to claim it.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer applicable.
Because of the passage of time.
Yes.
And those kind of statutes don't simply disappear out of the code the way in our operation of the code. We actually have to repeal them.
That's correct. And that's something I think that we see more in the tax law, where the sections remain. They're still effective. They're still the law, but because of their corresponding applicability clause, they actually have no meaning, and they, to get rid of them, we would have to repeal them and take an affirmative step to do that.
They just take up room without doing anything.
That's correct.
Right. All right. Other questions? I think we are going to have to look into the issues that Representative Riley raised, and for that reason, I don't intend to open a work session on the bill today. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 2065? I don't see anyone, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2065. And, Paul, I think we've exhausted our agenda for today, haven't we?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
You and I are going to have to work to get the committee adequate business because we've left 40 minutes on the table. But
forgive me, Mr. Chair, for the 40 extra minutes.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate the forgiveness. And with that, the committee is adjourned until tomorrow, yes?
Tomorrow morning we have a report on tax compliance from the Department of Revenue. Director Harchink will be here, go through that report with you. This was actually directed by a statute passed in February.
And remember, we're scheduled to have an adjourned meeting at 2 o'clock on the Reconnect bill. There will be an amendment proposed at that time. And with that, we are adjourned.